In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokon, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and artists sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, and above all, fair.
And this week we start with the events around Syria, which, along with Libya, is dramatically turning into another hotbed of international tension, with European governments increasing pressure on President Assad for his ongoing crackdown on opposition. While Europe is imposing oil embargo on Damascus and introducing other punitive measures, Russia is strongly opposing international sanctions. These days, Moscow is coming up with the alternative plan to restore peace and stability in Syria, unveiled by President Medvedev's special envoy in Damascus this week. So we will try to see where this clash of approaches voiced by world powers at the Security Council in New York will finally bring Syria and all of us here. And from Syria, we will turn our eyes to the developments in post-Soviet space, looking at the events in the Black Sea Republic of Abkhazia, which this week has celebrated the third anniversary of its independence, held presidential election, which saw acting president Alexander Ankwab elected as Abkhazia's third president. While Abkhazia is not yet recognized by the United States, which labels it Georgia's breakaway territory, in our second heading, Between the Lines, we will discuss a thought-provoking publication by a U.S. politician, Patrick Buchanan, who questions U.S. Senate's right to lecture Russia on Abkhazia and finds the Senate Resolution 175, which condemns the so-called Russian occupation of Southern Ossetia and Abkhazia, irrelevant. And finally, in our third heading, Man in the News, we will explore the phenomenon of Anna Hazare, a 74-year-old Indian peasant and public figure whose 13-day-long hunger strike, the climax of his anti-corruption campaign, has rocked the most populous world democracy, making Indian authorities to meet Anna Hazare's demands.
Well, Sergei, come to think of it, don't you think it would be interesting to see how the Indian protest summer differs or compares, rather, with Arab uprising, be it Egypt, Syria, Libya, whatever.
You know, Mira, what we see is a growing public discontent over social ills, with corruption being one of them, definitely. And in fact, corruption is a global phenomenon, as you know, but the way authorities handle social protests in India and elsewhere, say, in the Arab world, is totally different.
Well, to me, it's not surprising at all.
Yes, Mira, and what is different is also world approach to the mass protests. Call them uprisings or revolutions or public movements or whatever you want. And I think that there's a certain logic that this time we start from Syria, as Syrian crisis is a textbook example of how these things are handled in this world, which is not only interdependent, how we say in Red Line, but very contradictory too. So, beyond the headlines, this is our first heading in which we shall discuss the question, hotly debated by the world community, what to do with President Assad.
You're right, Sergei. Syria is a hot potato issue today. The six-month-old conflict has already claimed lives of more than 2,500 absolutely innocent civilians. And it brought the country on the brink of a large-scale fratricidal war.
Yes, Mira, and it is at this moment that world diplomacy is promptly turning to the crisis in Syria.
Well, with the battle in Libya not yet over, right?
Yes, Mira, but I think that mistakes made in Libya should be avoided in Syria. And that is why I say that Syria comes as a major test for the world powers today.
Well, but how will you define the main approaches to Syria, Sergei, the way they are shaping up today?
President Obama and his key European partners have made themselves very clear that President Bashar Assad should ultimately step down, and according to them, there's no place for him in the new democratic Syria. This is a very tough approach, but this is what we see.
Well, they don't have even a shade of
doubt in their minds.
Well, that's it, and I think that this rigid position is not going to be very productive.
If you ask me, I personally don't have an impression that Bashar's days are really numbered. And on one hand, yes, the country is raising against his rule with every Friday praying, and growing is the number of protesters who pledge not to give up protest till he resigns. But still, I strongly doubt that Assad's days are numbered, Mira.
Well, despite all the euphoria over the fall of Gaddafi regime, do you mean this?
I will put it this way. The West wants to give support to success of the so-called Arab Spring in Syria. And, as you understand, Libya-type military operation is out of the question. But But why not to try punitive measures like sanctions that bite?
Have you been watching the latest developments? Haven't you?
Of course, I watch the developments, and they're quite dramatic. And first of all, they're dramatic for Syrians, of course. As I was saying, this week European Union has imposed ban on imports of crude oil from Syria. And I think this was the strongest ever move to make President Assad to comply with Western demands. And the ban will deprive Syrian budget of annually more than 3 billion euros. That's a lot. And you know, Mira, while preparing for the program, I came across an interesting quote from Adib Mayalech, who is the head of the Central Bank of Syria. And here is what he says. I said the opposite of what Queen Maria Antoinette advised her hungry nation, to eat cake if they have no bread. I suggest we give up cake to eat plain bread. No doubt the sanctions will make Syrians tighten their belts.
Well, Ataboy, the banker, hasn't lost his sense of humor. Though it looks to me that there is pretty... the situation in Damascus is too tight for jokes. But anyway, three cheers. Well, if the sanctions are so bad and they don't look very effective either, what do you think is the alternative?
Well, that's the main question, Mira. And I understand that there is no guarantee that Russia's approach worked, but still Moscow sees an alternative to this Western approach. And as I said, this week President Medvedev has sent a personal message to President Assad, and it was delivered by Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov, who visited Damascus. And Mr. Bogdanov called for an immediate ceasefire by both the Syrian government and the opposition, and urged Assad to implement his promised reforms without delay.
Do I have to ask whether this scenario is not welcomed by the West, which sees this change of Syrian leadership as an absolute precondition to any further development of Syria, well, presumably in a democratic manner?
This approach is not welcomed by the West, and it is not surprising, Mira, that actually, as things stand now, there are two basically different international approaches on Syria, and they have already generated two rival draft resolutions that have been submitted to the UN Security Council.
Don't go into details, Sergei, but just tell me, what do you think is the basic difference between the rival drafts?
Okay, very briefly.
Yeah.
One draft backed by Britain, France, Germany, Portugal, and the United States, obviously, calls for freezing foreign assets of President Bashar Assad, his brother Maher, who is one of the Syrian top military brass, and of 21 other senior government officials and businessmen. And one of them is Bashar's cousin, all-powerful Syrian tycoon Rami Makhlouf.
Oh, that one.
Who reportedly controls Syrian mobile phone network and other enterprises, and has been the target of many opposition protests.
Do you think it might work?
I would say that the proposed measures are aimed at producing a sort of suffocating effect for Syrian leadership. It is meant to deprive them of funds they desperately need. But, of course, the Western-backed resolution is opposed by Russia, and not only Russia, but China and other countries, who made themselves clear they will never support it.
So what next?
Look, it means Russia doesn't want just to stir up the Syrian opposition like it has been done in Libya before.
Why should it? Why
yes.
Should it?
So, as an alternative to the Western plan, we in Moscow here introduce another draft, which, by the way, was co-sponsored by China, as I said, and also South Africa and Brazil. And the draft is calling for an immediate end of all violence, and it doesn't mention any sanctions, which is very important.
The basic difference between the two drafts, as I see it, is the attitude to President Assad personally, his future, on which future of Syria also hinges in the eyes of the West.
Exactly. And while the Western-backed draft is mistrustful of Syrian leader, who is already written off by President Obama and his key partners, Moscow still envisages a role for President Bashar Assad in new reformed Syria, despite all his wrongdoings.
Well, all in all, the situation with two rival resolutions on Syria looks like a classical diplomatic deadlock.
Well, this is a deadlock, Mira, but on the other hand, still there's a time, I believe, to find a last-minute compromise. But the situation is pretty serious because some of the Western diplomats are accusing Russia of what they call a maneuver to hijack the negotiation.
And how fair is this accusation, I'd like to know?
Well, let us not be driven by emotions. Let us explore the arguments of both sides.
Okay. So
let's take a closer look at the events in Syria. Mass riots in Syria started in mid-March after Facebook call for a day of dignity. And that was actually the same way as anti-government riots were launched in Tunisia and Egypt. And as the country was rocked by riots, unprecedented in scale, parallels with Libya became more of.
Well, however, Sergei, with all the obvious parallels with Libya, how is old Bashar? 45?
45,
no,
yes.
45. That means that he's almost of the same age as Gaddafi's rule in Libya is.
That's a good point, Vila.
Well, anyway, it just came to my mind. But I think that, I mean, they're not really similar. Though I don't have much admiration for Assad, but still, I must say that he doesn't altogether look like a classical regional Arab despot. He evokes mixed feelings.
Yes, I can agree with this, and I think his moves are sending conflicting messages. On one hand, definitely he's trying to rule with iron fist, tolerating no dissent, the way his father, the late President Hafez Assad, did. But on the other hand, he has lifted the country's 48-year-old emergency law.
Well, I think that was a major concession to the opposition, and actually few people expected that Bashar would do it, right?
Mira, and that was not the only concession. This week, Bashar Assad went further with his reforms, scrapping the old media rules. This is another milestone, you know. So, and we journalists should be proud for that, I think. So, according to new regulations, media should be independent and serve their message freely, restricted only by the Constitution and the law. This is something, Mira.
Not bad if implemented. We
if
are
implemented,
journalists,
yeah. And just a couple more quotes from Bashar Assad showing that he is really capable to understand the pressing need for change. So, one quote. The world is rapidly changing around us, and we have to keep up with developments. This is what he said. And here is another quote from Bashar Assad. We have to focus on the demands and aspirations of the people, or there will be a sense of anger. That's what we see, the sense of anger.
Sergei, listen, just lovely. Sounds well, but on the other hand, it is equally true that so far he has failed to cultivate an image of an Arab leader with reformist leanings. In reality, not many people see him in this image.
So, but do you see this as just good talk or something more?
Well, yes, look, it's a good talk, but I'd like to see good practice, right?
But why the reforms go so slowly?
Well, there are many explanations, and you know that one of the things which is often said about Bashar is that we know that he never meant to be a president. It was a matter of coincidence, right?
That's right.
Well, rather tragic coincidence. And when he stepped in, quite unexpectedly for himself too, he has been naturally tightly surrounded by his father's old guard.
Yeah, let me elaborate on that. This is an important subject. This old political elite, there was no change of elite in Syria.
Bashar didn't have a broken chance of changing the elite at that time. Let's be fair about him.
And I think that still this old political elite largely determines his politics still now. So, as a result, he had a very limited number of options, a limited field for maneuver, and this is something they don't understand at the West.
It's not surprising that with one foot firmly planted in the past Bashar is simply besotted by conspiracy theories, trying to put all the blame for Syrian protests on the outside enemy, be it the Islamists or the West or whoever else.
Mira, to sum it up, let me put it this way. Syria and its leaders are currently at the crossroads, and the situation is very dangerous in many ways. If ethnic and religious strife continues, Syria's sovereignty might be jeopardized. And some even say that under the worst scenario, Syria might fall apart. Can you imagine the implications for the region?
As I understand from what you say, Sergei, the skeptical Western approach to Bashar's reform can be summarized in a formula, well, quite applicable to the situation: too little and too late.
But my question is, who can measure the pace of the reforms in a country like Syria, which is just awakening from decades-long lethargic sleep?
That's a good question to which there is no answer.
That's a good question. And finally, let us not forget that a potential power vacuum in Damascus, if Bashar is ousted, would bring about unpredictable consequences for the vast Mideast region. Let us not forget about that. And as for Bashar al-Assad, I think he faces a clear choice: to end hostilities and pioneer much-awaited changes, or to be driven out by old political habits, by old inertia, to completely lose his historic chance and fail to meet Syrian people's needs and to find himself nowhere.
Well, we didn't touch one thing, but perhaps that would be too much. It doesn't depend only on the Western approach and the, for the brevity's sake, Russian approach. There are neighbors of Syria who will also play a big role in the future, and we don't know what it would be.
I think we have to discuss this with our experts. Now on the line is Mr. Yevgeny Satanovsky, who is the president of the Moscow-based Institute of Middle East Studies. And I think he has a lot to tell us about the role of the regional as well as global players.
Right.
Mr. Satanovsky, thank you for joining us. Russia and the West have locked horns over Syria. Do you believe both parties can reach compromise in the Security Council, as there are two rival draft resolutions on Syria?
Up to my mind, there is no chance that's good end. The Western bloc, what we are seeing now, organize some informational and political basement for the intervention. For the military intervention, like it was organized in Libya, based on the United Nations resolution. The Russian, and we have some guarantees that the Chinese position is much more careful. We're not so radical because we have the Libyan experience, and that's a very negative experience. And neither Moscow, nor China, nor Beijing want such end in Syria, which practically destroy the whole Levant area, the whole Eastern Mediterranean. So we'll see what it will be. Anyway, the Libyan campaign ruined the Russian and Chinese interest in the Libyan economy. If that will be in Syria, that's absolutely no chance that Russia will vote for the Western resolution, or it will be something like that. What compromise is possible to have? That's the Western problem.
Well, but at any rate, do you still believe that Russia and the West can reach last-minute compromise and work out some comprehensive draft resolution?
The problem is that the civil war in Syria, which beginning we have now, was initiated not only by illegal activity of the Bashar al-Assad leaders of the Minister of Defense and Police, but also by Doha and the area, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, in their non-formal war with Islamic Republic of Iran, won't replace Bashar Assad. They need Syria without Iranian influence. They want to destroy maybe this country, because the civil war in Syria will really have terrible end. We have 5 or 6 different formal Turkish provinces, governors, they will be independent one of each other. But that is what they really want. That's not true that the Western countries, the Western bloc by itself, won't do something. That's the Arab game inside the Arab world. And in this situation, Russia won't compromise and won't save Bashar al-Assad as a leader of the country, cause anarchy is something terrible. There will be really rivers of blood after that and destroyment of country. Even Israelis don't want destroyment of Syria and replacement of Assad. But the Western bloc just now is not more than instrument in the hands of Doha and their Riyadh. They really need something another. What compromise can be reached in this situation, I cannot understand.
So, as I understand, according to you, Mr. Satanovsky, West doesn't have any independent interests in Syria.
Of course, West have an independent interest in Syria, and independent interest in Syria also includes destroyment of Syrian-Iranian alliance. The only problem is that in this case, egoistic interests, financial interests, political interests, security interests in the question of Iran, not of Syria, are absolutely out of reality of Syria under Assad. The Russian interest is not destroyment of the whole area. So what compromise can we have? And how will Orthodox Wahhabit Arab monarchies reach their goal if Bashar al-Assad will be safe as the president of Syria?
Well, you sound pessimistic, Mr. Satanovsky, but you might have a point, definitely. But coming back to Bashar Assad, his future, in your personal view, is Assad a goner or does he still have a chance? Because now there's a lot of talk about his future, so what is your assessment?
Tell the truth, that's the last thing which I'm interested in, the future of the Arab leaders in the time of Arab Spring. Who remember the European leaders? Their names and their future on the beginning of the First or Second World War. Assad maybe have a chance if he will be brutal enough. His problem is he try be brutal. He won't be as his father, but he cannot. He's not Hafez al-Assad. He's not more than Bashar al-Assad. And that's really his problem. Because it's much better have some heavy conflict for the brief time that heavy conflict for the long, long months which we have now in Syria.
So you think that his chance is just to tighten the screws, not just to unveil and go ahead with democratic reforms? Do you mean to say this?
We have not the humor show now, so please don't discuss the democratic reform in the Arab world. Will it be in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya or Syria? That's a question of Islamization, radical or not. That's a question of destroyment of national consensus and destroyment of the Christian community. That's a question of interconfessional and international conflict between Druzes, Arabs, Kurds, so on. If that's democracy, I'm very sorry, that's not good democracy. But anyway, Hitler was voting for the power by the democratic way. Maybe that type of democracy we'll have in the Middle East.
Well, I got your point, Mr. Satanovsky. And my final question is, what, in your assessment, might happen to Syria if Bashar is forced to resign? Can we expect any calamities? Can we expect that the country will fall apart or will turn into a springboard of terrorism?
We'll have a combination of Iraqi situation and the situation in Libya. Upgrading level of Al-Qaeda, Brothers Muslim, which are much more radical in Syria than in Egypt, really rivers of blood of Christians and different national groups, conflict between Kurds and Arabs, exactly destroyment for a few parts. That is war of everybody against everybody. And because in Syria we have also from million to million and a half Iraqis refugees and around 400,000 Palestinian refugees, and we have Lebanon with its situation of failing state, the whole area will be in the hands of Sunni Islamized groups, which will be maybe good for conservative Arab monarchies, but not so good for the future of secularism, whose last representative in the Arab world after Algeria is the Syrian president.
And what are the implications for Israel?
Israelis will look at this situation and understand that there is so good that they not agree with Bashar al-Assad about the Golan Heights, which in this case, if that will be peace agreement between them and Syria will be in the hands of radical Islamists and the Syrian army, and wait, because just now they have a position of militarized Switzerland in Europe in the beginning of the Second World War.
So, as I understand, the so-called Syrian track in the Middle East settlement will be also affected.
What can we do? Nothing good. No optimism at all. Maybe Russia can make some balance, stopping the Western Qatar and Saudi attacking on the Syrian situation. Maybe not. Anyway, we'll have some interest time on this corner of Mediterranean.
Thank you very much, Mr. Satanovsky, for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're tuned in to the Voice of Russia.
And with this, we are moving to Red Line's second heading, Between the Lines, where we usually discuss what we believe to be the most thought-provoking publication of the week. 3 years after the August 2008 war in South Ossetia, which led to the disintegration of Georgia and emergence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent sovereign states, the issue of their sovereignty remains another hotly debated issue in Russia's relations with the United States and the West. While Russia sees Georgia as undeniable aggressor in the five-day war of August 2008 and believes it has every political and moral right to recognize them as sovereign states, our American partners regrettably see the things in a different way. It was reported that before departing for summer vacation, the Senate voted to declare Abkhazia and South Ossetia to be provinces of Georgia illegally occupied by Russian troops who must get out and return to Russia, according to U.S. Senate. The controversy which mars Russian-American reset is analyzed in an opinion, Why Are We Baiting the Bear?, contributed to the website of the newspaper The Post Chronicle by a ranking U.S. politician, Patrick Buchanan. Who are we to demand that they return to the rule of Tbilisi, writes Mr. Buchanan, who insists that Senate Resolution 175, which condemns the so-called Russian occupation of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, is irrelevant and doesn't cope up with reality.
Well, needless to say that the bear is Russia and the baiting and things. Actually, what is interesting about the publication is that it's a very uncommon view to come from Washington. Don't you think so, Sophie?
This is definitely a very uncommon view. And on the one hand, Patrick Buchanan's opinion changes nothing. Just days after the publication of the story, State Department responded to the recent election in Abkhazia, which was held last Sunday, and Washington insisted that they don't recognize the legitimacy of the results of what they called so-called election in Abkhazia. But on the other hand, Mira, Patrick Buchanan is quite convincing. While obviously not being involved in any propaganda or information war between Russia and Georgia, and I think the time has come yet to his ideas to define American policy. But eventually, I believe one day it might be changed.
Well, you say convincing, Sergei. What do you mean by it? Each side believes it is convincing. Each side believes it knows the truth.
Well, Mira, he's convincing when he explains that Washington should not lecture Russia, as such lecturing sounds offending. And here is a quote. Going on across this inflamed region are ethno-national struggles for self-determination, the resolution of which 6,000 miles from the United States is none of our concern. How would Abraham Lincoln have reacted had Tsar Alexander II declared the Russian Empire was recognizing the independence of Virginia and demanding that the breakaway enclave of West Virginia will be returned to Richmond?
Excellent.
Can we see how hypocritical we appear? This is what Pat Buchanan writes.
This is a very good one, but let me say that Russia's stand on Abkhazia, at least as I see it, has nothing to do with notorious Brzezinski's chess game, nothing to do with great powers' former clash over the spheres of interest and so on.
Regarding chess game, I will put it this way. Abkhazia is neither Russia's backyard nor Russia's client state with a puppet president. But Having said that, I want to emphasize that it is more than just a territory for us here. Abkhazia is a reality, unique in many ways, culture, religion, habits, tradition, everything. And not only is Abkhazia close to Russia geographically, as well as in terms of history and ethnicity, but it also counts many Russian citizens as permanent residents.
So naturally, any developments in this neighboring country are significant for Russia.
And this is why Pat Buchanan is asking, why are we provoking a Russia for whom the Caucasus, ablaze as it is with secessionism, Islamism, and terrorism, is a vital national interest? And as for hypocrisy mentioned by Pat Buchanan, it is fraught with many dangers. We all live in this interconnected world where we no longer can afford hypocrisy verging on worse. And I shall be blunt, I don't believe that the West is all that concerned with tiny Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Incidentally, why are the two always coupled, despite being so different on so many counts? There having been administrative parts of Soviet Georgia doesn't wipe off dissimilarity between them. Let us not forget about it.
Well, Sergei, Mr. Buchanan's article deals with another example of Western hypocrisy, and the name is Kosovo.
Mira, there are many other examples to cite. But what I want to point out is that all the games played around the breakaway so-called provinces of Georgia have Russia as the primary aim. Don't you find it? And to me, it is very frustrating, very frustrating.
But I think we have to highlight another aspect of the game. Don't you find that the Senate resolution backing Georgia has greatly stirred up the local revanchist moods?
President Saakashvili, as you know, has a big headache with the so-called Abkhazians, Georgians ousted from Abkhazia in the early 90s. Really, it was a dark age of the first years after the collapse of the Soviet Empire in 1991, and it is already at that time that the native Abkhazians started their fight for independence. I was told there are about 250,000 of them, and they want to go back to Abkhazia, reclaim their property and settle there, and there President Saakashvili's voters and revanchists ready for anything.
So Georgia, naturally, called the Abkhazian election illegitimate, which was predictable. Nobody doubted it. As you said, Abkhazia threw off Georgian rule in wars, fought for it in the early 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
A friend of mine, Mira, who is just back from Abkhazia, said he saw the ruins of residential areas in Abkhazian cities laid waste during the war for independence in 92-93. So according to him, the areas still have not been rebuilt. And he also spoke of the improvised roadside memorials that dot the entire country commemorating the casualties of that war.
I also have many friends in Abkhazia, and I have seen those memorials. They are really very moving. There was a lot of suffering. But let me say that my friend's family, at least for the last 3 years, is happy that they can go to sleep at night without thinking of Kalashnikov or any other weapon, just in case Georgia attacks again. This is a fact. So Mr. Buchanan is absolutely right when he says that whatever are the circumstances, Russians are more welcome in Abkhazia and Ossetia too than Georgians. It's a fact.
Mira, and these people who gave up their Kalashnikovs, they have come to appreciate the peace and quite greatly. And they know they have Russia to thank for that.
Yes, who else? Russia it was. Look, Sergei, admittedly, each of the conflicting parties will have their own arguments and reasoning and things. And each of the stories is true in its own manner, in its own way. Only time can solve the problem.
I think, Mira, Pat Buchanan also makes this point. But after discussing this publication, let us hear one more voice from American media. And now we are joined by Fred Weir, correspondent with Christian Science Monitor. Fred, thanks for joining us. So, Pat Buchanan, in his story, says that Senate had no right to criticize Russia on Abkhazia and South Assyria. Do you share this view?
Well, I think it's important to note that Pat Buchanan is a very prominent member of the Republican Party. He ran in presidential primaries twice in the 1990s, but he is of that part of the Republican Party, that wing of the party, that is often termed isolationist, which means his criticism isn't based on any particular love of Russia or support for Russian positions. His position is that the United States should not get involved in very large parts of the world where it can only do bad. This is his argument in that particular article, that the United States is just unnecessarily antagonizing Russia over a matter that the United States has no business involving itself in. So this is a position, but it's a minority position within the Republican Party, and it's not going to be widely accepted. But today, in the Republican Party, the same position is held by Ron Paul, who is part of that wing of the party, the same as Buchanan is. And Ron Paul is not only running in the presidential primaries, he's doing very well in using these same arguments that the United States should get out of a lot of these foreign entanglements. Has no business being in Iraq or Afghanistan, building an empire, having troops in Korea or in Germany still. This is what is often termed isolationism. And it is surprising that it's doing well in the Republican presidential primaries so far.
Fred, have you been to Abkhazia yourself? Have you seen the developments in the Republic?
Yes, I spent a couple of weeks in Abkhazia in 2008, just before the war, just weeks before the war broke out. And first of all, I was stunned by the natural beauty of that place. It really is an amazing natural creation that will do very well if they can solve their political problems. I'm sure that even when I was there, there were enormous numbers of Russian tourists in places like Gagra, and I'm sure that this will only get better, that their prospects excellent. But especially in the southern part of Abkhazia, Sukhumi, and further, I went all the way down to the border there. Most of the infrastructure is still destroyed from the war. In the capital, Sukhumi, even lots of buildings are still bombed out. They have an enormous amount of work to do.
But do you believe that it can develop into a sovereign state?
Sure. I don't see why not. We know there are lots and lots of places that are members of the United Nations, little tiny dots on the map, which are sovereign states. It's not rocket science, apparently, to manage as a sovereign state, because some of the places in Africa or the South Pacific never would make it if there were high standards for statehood. So, sure, Abkhazia has lots of preconditions to be a sovereign state. It just has, it's caught in the political gears or geopolitical gears, which prevent it from being recognized by the world, because the world, and particularly the West, argues that it has to settle its issues with Georgia. And it is, under international law, this is true, under international law, it is part of sovereign Georgia. And this is an issue that's got to be worked out.
Fred, can I ask you one question about Russian-American relations?
Sure.
So, as you know, this Abkhazian and South Ossetia issue is a bone of contention in our relations. So, do you think it can really jeopardize notorious reset process? It can poison our relations? Or we have agreed to disagree on the subject?
Yeah, I think that the worst moment, of course, was at the time of the 2008 war. And that was when this all blew up and George W. Bush was still president of the United States, and he had a fairly hostile attitude toward Russia. So I don't think that this is going to get worse. It remains a frozen problem. These problems remain, and they can blow up in the future. There's no doubt about that.
Well, this is politics, but let us hope for the beauty of compromise which will prevail in our relations, Fred.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You are listening to the Voice of Russia, one of the oldest radio stations in the world.
And now the time has come to move on to Red Line's concluding heading, Man in the News. This week, the man we talk about is Mr. Anna Hazare, a 74-year-old Indian public figure who ended his 2-week hunger strike against corruption in New Delhi, making Indian Parliament to bow to his demands to tighten anti-corruption legislation, which, if implemented, will leave top Indian public figures and political figures with no immunity. Anna Hazare, who is a former peasant, ex-army driver, and one-man army in a fight against widespread Indian corruption, staged a protest in the center of Indian capital, which rocked the most populous world democracy, making embattled Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to say he applauds Anna Hazare.
He does applaud Anna Hazare, and I must say that the summing up of the event has already started in India. I would agree, I mean, trying to assess it, I would agree with Mr. Saudik Biswas, a renowned Indian journalist, has written that what happened, I mean, Hazare's campaign was a reality check for India. Indeed, it is for the first time in decades, I would say, that the ruling political elite of India is being directly exposed to frustrated masses and is made to hear their demands.
Yes, Mira, and that is why what Anna Hazare has done, to me, is truly an extraordinary thing. This is something one can hardly believe in, regardless of whether the parliament will finally approve all the amendments to legislation proposed by Anna Hazare or not. And I think that while lying on bed covered with white lining under the huge portrait of Mahatma Gandhi, Anna Hazare outplayed Indian authorities.
There was another thing that added to the development of the protest movement. The Indian authorities made a silly mistake, which they regretted almost immediately. They put Anna Hazare behind the bars. That immediately galvanized the whole India, and the government, naturally, next day released him, but one day was enough. The harm was done. I mean, not the harm, but the movement has been really reinforced.
Mira, you are absolutely right, but it took them just one day to understand that they made a mistake and not a drop of blood was spilled.
And this
is a point, Mira. Yes. And India is by no means Egypt or Syria.
No, not at all. India is a democracy, whereas none in the Arab countries, so far, there is no democracy. So it's a different thing. And another thing, what happened, what Hazare's movement was, I would say, a typically Indian phenomenon. Would it happen in an Arab country? I mean, it couldn't happen there. It would have been drowned in blood and suppressed.
I can't imagine that, say, President Bashar Assad, whom we discussed today, would act in the same way, you know.
So, of course not.
But I think that by not jailing this anti-corruption activist, Indian authorities really showed an ability to seek compromise and consensus. And I also applaud Prime Minister Manmohan Singh for not being scared of Mr. Hazare's call for the second Indian revolution.
Well, yes. As for the second Indian revolution, there was never a revolution in Indian history, as a matter of fact. But never mind. It is a revolution. Some analysts call it a new type of revolution, whereas the others call it a social evolution.
But which definition would you personally prefer?
I would rather prefer the one that was given by Mr. Biswas. It is really a reality check. For the first time, the Indian establishment was made to see a movement which presented to it its demands, well articulated and spelled, and mind you, this is a very important thing. We saw the pictures coming from TV and things. No broken windows, no burned car. It was a really non-violent movement controlled by the rules put forward by Hazare.
So this is not a street mob of angry protesters,
but
an organized movement of people demanding to have a say in national decision-making. This is something, really. But Mira, do you believe that hunger strikes like this is the best method in today's India?
Well, listen, the India remembers how effectively Mahatma Gandhi used them during the struggle for independence. But that was 60 years ago. As for Hazare, a hunger strike is not a novelty for him. Actually, there was a hunger strike that he staged in April. That was the beginning of the campaign. And this one is number 16, I think. Did you know that? Because he built his reputation in Maharashtra, where he had to confront the local government, local bureaucracy, and he had hunger strikes there. And I would say they have been, by and large, successful.
Mira, but he raised against the corruption. What sort of person is he?
He is a peasant, it's a fact. He was an army driver. He became a social figure, recognized social figure. Number one, he's a self-made man from beginning to the end. Secondly, he is a very strange combination. He is a pragmatic visionary. He has a vision, but he does know how to implement it. And the main thing, perhaps, Sergei, he is a man of the masses, one with the masses, knowing the masses, understood by the masses.
The way I see it, Mira, Mr. Hazara's movement is the triumph of Indian democracy. And it should be regarded as a victory for people, because it demonstrated that fighting for better and strongly laws is no longer the preserve of politicians and media and business tycoons.
I agree, Sergei. I do agree. This is the coming of age of the Indian street suit. As people demand more from their politicians. Yet, on the other hand, opening the debate on the amendments to the controversial anti-corruption law, the stalwart of Indian politics, Mr. Pranab Mukherjee, said that India was at a crossroads. Now listen, Sergei, with the focus squarely on the country's parliamentary democracy. It's a very important thing.
And a couple of days before him, Rahul Gandhi, a scion of Nehru Gandhi family, who is widely seen as the prime minister in waiting, sounded a similar warning. While praising Hazara, he also criticized the movement for setting a dangerous precedent for a democracy by trying to dictate the demands to parliament.
In all honesty, I must say that Indian media has not been balanced in projecting Hazare and his movement. Well, it has been noted and again that a hunger strike needs the oxygen of publicity.
Well, although public interest in it wanes if the case at stake does not withstand public scrutiny, Mira.
Well, we know that Hazare's project campaign has plenty of oxygen, probably a bit too much of it. As for the validity of the campaign, I mean, no question, right?
Yet Indian media's almost unanimous support has finally led many to argue that sections of the media, at least TV and print, have openly sided with Mr. Hazare and that the neutrality of the media has been seriously compromised. But, you know, media is criticized too often in this world, not only in India.
Well, but Sergei, come on. As journalists, we cannot really speak about the neutrality of media. Actually, I'd be embarrassed
to speak also.
About it. Are we? Anyway, but it was a made-for-media event. Just look at it this way. Anti-corruption hunger strike. A patriarchal activist with an excellent record leading it. Men and women, young and old, every come and join him. It's so colorful. It's so beautiful. A three-dimension colorful microcosm of restless, angry, hungry India. What could be better?
And writer on India's leading media watchdog site, The Hoot, Archana Venkat, said that the Indian media, mainly TV, was appointing their counterparts in the US by taking sides on every issue worthy of public consumption. And it was reported that his team was actively using Twitter, Facebook, and other social networking sites.
Of course, Hazare's team would use all the modern gadgets. But look, it was making, I don't mean Hazare's movement, but the media was making very good money.
Corruption-free.
Corruption-free. But I think taxes would be there. Anyway, none of our business, right, Sergei? As Hazare started his first hunger strike in April, there were 655 hours of coverage. And the coverage mopped up $38 million worth of advertising for the news channels. How do you like this?
I believe that it is high time to hear an Indian voice and voice of Indian media, I would say, to explain the phenomenon of Anna Hazare. And now we are joined by Vinay Shukla, that Press Trust of India Agency Moscow Bureau head. Mr. Shukla, thank you for joining us. So today we are discussing the phenomenon of Anna Hazare. Now, as the dust has settled, at least for the time being, how do you assess the results of the standoff between the people and the establishment?
I would say that India has changed, that India is no more which was before the parliament accepted the demands of Mr. Hazare. And this is a really a challenging time, and it's for the establishment, because the masses have their grievances and they found a leader who could somehow spearhead their demands. So that way I would say that India has changed, and there's a big challenge for the establishment.
But in what way does it change? Can you spell it out?
The way that, you see, the Indians were very becoming, you know, politically indifferent, in the sense that everybody knew the politics is a dirty game, it's full of corruption and everything. But, and they were, say, resigned to it, accept it. And especially, you know, in the recent months, India has been witnessing several scams, including the mobile allocation frequencies and all that. And several leaders and ministers are in the prison these days. And on this background, this Hazare phenomenon has galvanized the Indian society, the Indian civil society, I would say, which was not very much part of the establishment and was not in the main channel of the politics.
Thank you, Mr. Shukla. That was a good insight, really. And with this, we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by me, Sergei Strokhan, and Mira Salganik. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Goodbye. So long. Bye. 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 So long.